Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of February 28th, 2016. This is Jack Brissett Mills. I was at George's house and had a great talk, and I'll share that with you in a minute. First, the verses. These are written after Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul verses. This is for his week 48. I wrote this one 2 years ago. Verse 48. I feel within the light now streaming toward this dear earth a power to help our thinking rise above the mundane, to solve life's riddles by awakening love in our hearts. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse. 48a. The light of early spring has such a power. I feel it clarify my mind, driving away the darkness, so that love may arise to solve my deepest question. Yeah, George had a day off, and we talked at his house, and the kids were in the other part of the house, but you can still hear him now and then. Thank you, George. That was really fun. Here you go.
It was a class that I took. It was called Moral Issues. And that was, I think, if I had to say, like, the focal point of my college career, that was where things really hit home. And I took it in a time that I was questioning, not so much even questioning, I was really researching my background and belief systems, and I wound up in the Moral Issues course. And I, up until that time, I thought I was sort of searching for an answer, or searching for, like, some guidance or direction.
It's interesting you even say that, because what's the question?
Yeah, that's true. And I guess at that time, the question is, what should I believe in? Because yeah. I grew up in a certain faith.
There you are.
And I had, you know, as high school relationships go, I thought mine, you know, mine was as important as anyone else's. But it was I had been dating an Israeli girl at the time, and her family and my family, there was an obvious schism because of the different faith background. She was Israeli Jew, and I don't know, I guess you could call us Methodists. That's the church we go to.
Yeah.
And it was a big problem, and it never really figured or sat well with me at all. Because, you know, I thought, you know, what I understood with my limited experience and emotional, you know, relationships, it felt strong, and I didn't understand what the problem was.
Yeah. And you probably want to reason it out, because I think a lot of people just say, he's not a Jew, or he's not a Christian, and they don't even go into what's wrong with that. They just simply say, that's not going to work.
Yeah, the labels. But I realized, up until I took that Moral Issues course, I was, you know, angry, and I was studying these religions, you know, in retrospect, to get ammunition. And that's what it seemed like. It's like the more I learned these different perspectives on religion, the more I got ammunition to go against my mom, who was the big, I guess, religious figure of my family.
Yeah, and she must have had her own, too. I mean, the girl.
I mean, Seagal and I, that was her name, Seagal and I, you know, we both didn't see the point of all the trouble.
Yeah.
But she, by that time, she had gone, her parents had whisked her away to Israel.
Okay.
They were taking her away out of the situation.
Yeah.
And that was the last time I saw her.
Wow.
So I was angry.
Yeah.
When I got to the Moral Issues course, John started to teach me about the subtext of life, the presuppositions that we take whenever we go in.
I love that phrase. We should make a book, The Subtext of Life.
He didn't have any, there weren't any grades, there weren't any things you turned in. You basically came in, you discussed. The only thing he ever asked of you was to read the book Heart of Darkness by Conrad. And, you know, as you're reading it, I don't know if you've ever read it.
Nope, I should.
If you go into it without any, I guess, help, it's not a very interesting story. And, you know, the way John would walk you through this, because he is, you know, his background, he used to be a priest, and he fluent in Greek and, you know, reading. He was amazed by old texts, by old classical literature, and one of the my favorite things that he liked to talk about is how the old books like to talk to each other. You know, if you knew the history going and when things were being written, and you looked at what else was being published, you could see how sometimes they'd be referencing each other, or at least talking to each other. My favorite was his discussion on Melville's Moby Dick, on how Melville at the time was counter to Ralph Waldo Emerson's view of Christianity, and how he can liken that scene at the pulpit before Ishmael goes off to like Ralph Waldo Emerson's view. And his description of the whale itself was very much like that pulpit experience. You have this big bashing head and the tail follows along. So, with a story like The Heart of Darkness, I know why he chose it, because certainly if you're just there to read it, it's not like it's not a very fun read. If you're just sitting down and reading it, it's weird that you have this character, Marlowe, who's telling this group of fellow sailors on a boat on the Thames River about his trip up the Congo. And there was a movie, Apocalypse Now, that was made that sort of mirrors that thing. But then he asks you to look at it differently, and he starts picking out little things, little hints that, you know, this character, he'll tell you he doesn't speak French very well, knowing full well that now that he's in the Congo, everyone's speaking French to him. And, you know, these weird little things like fossil ivory that the character's like, I don't know what they're talking about with fossil ivory. And then, you know, John, who also knows French, he's like, if you study the words fossil and fusil, you know, fuselage, like rifle, like, so there's a lot of poaching going on underneath, and at that time, you know, there's a big ivory trade coming in.
Poached ivory, then,
So, this story, you know, all of a sudden just starts exploding with color and imagination.
And there's some insanity in Apocalypse Now. There's going so far in that you lose your way. You're lost.
And that's the darkness part. And it's funny because in Apocalypse Now, in the making of it, a lot of the actors were...
Because they're out in there. They're in the jungle. Yeah.
Well, they were also, you know, imbibing on, you know, narcotics or whatever. But it's funny because in the book... In the Heart of Darkness book, there, you know, if you know what's in the teas and the tobaccos and stuff, there are a lot of them are laced with cocaine back at the time. So the same sort of experiences are being met. It's just funny how, you know, how the movie is. I don't know if it's knowingly or unknowingly talking to the book. And
was religion definitely in that book? Was it a study of religion in that book, or that John?
No, so John, so that's, he never really, you know, brought religion on the table, because I think if you, you know, any time I've ever been in a class where that happens,
very careful.
You know, it gets very volatile.
Yes,
but he did one time, you know, saying like, you know, if you question this, you should question some religions, because this religion is telling you that, you know, up there in the sky is this invisible person, you can't see him, you can't go find him, you know, it's just like, you just have to believe and have faith in that.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah. I think that's the definition of religion in a way. It gets away from a direct experience. If you have a direct experience of something, you can start your own religion. Because religions are based on someone somewhere in the past having a direct experience.
Mm.
Then they tell people what happened. And then other people believe in that person who's telling the story. They're not having their own direct experience necessarily, but they're believing in the person who tells the story about their direct experience. And so when I think of religion, I think of people trying to believe in what someone else said happened to them. And I'm really always looking for people who have their own experience. And I want to hear is anyone having their own experience about it? Or is it all a belief? Is it all just a hope and a belief in someone else's story?
I see that, like, in my work a lot. I call it religion because I have a hard time finding a different term for it. I mean, one example would be, a popular example would be vaccinations. And, you know, humans, to my experience and from what I've read and people who have studied this, are very anecdotal.
Yes, yes.
We like our stories.
Yep.
Like, you know, I sometimes think if someone told me that, you know, I had a 99-1% chance to win, 99-1 to win the lottery today.
Yeah.
I just played this one number,
yeah.
Or just bought a ticket. And then if this one guy comes, I just bought a ticket and I lost.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder, like, how many people would not buy a ticket just because I've got this statistic on one side and this person's emotional experience on the other. It's just so powerful.
Yeah. There was a cute statement of that where 1 in 4 chance if you text while driving, you'll get in an accident. People still text while driving, but if it's 1 in 10 million, you'll win the lottery. They'll say, well, you never know. And they'll go for the 1 in 10 million shot. And they won't care at all about the 1 in 4 shot.
Well, I don't know why. What is that? Is I mean, I try to rack my brain, like, how? Because I'm susceptible to it, too. I know I do it. I know I'm influenced by the story. But when it comes to things that I've read, like,
so you were talking about religion, and you're talking about following the belief of someone else, and then you talked about vaccinations. What were you trying to say about that? Oh, that people don't want it because they heard someone say.
Yeah, I've had this negative experience with this. I mean, they like to say autism, and they have all this evidence to say that guy that did that was wrong. There was nothing to tie it other to it. But yet they believe it, and they want to believe it.
Yeah.
You know, and I see these parents that have these severely autistic children, and I can't imagine their struggle.
It's horrible.
And I look at what I believe, like, religion does, and these parents that have autistic children, they need that comfort.
It might be helpful not to blame their own genetics or whatever, or their own upbringing in the house somehow, but some outside force. I'm sure it's more comforting, but
why does religion do that? Why does it, I don't know, I think in their mind it seems protective for them. Like, if they had to, you know, come face to face with it, they wouldn't be able to handle it. But I don't know if that's true. I think if they did face it, you know, I have more faith in them as a person, and the strength of them as a person. Like, they would be able to understand that. I don't like to think that people are not equipped to understand or cope with their own faults or decisions or whatever label you want to apply to it.
It seems like we turn toward what makes us feel better, whatever that means. To me, it means health. I turn toward health. And if I have a decision to make, somehow in my soul, I can feel which one is better for me, health. If I'm a healthy person, if I'm not screwed up, I have a good sense of what's right and wrong to eat, to do, what time to go to bed, all these things. I have this sense of health, and I say, I should probably stop eating now, I should leave now. All these things come out of a feeling, this is better for me somehow. As an organism, I'm trying to stay alive, trying to be healthy. And I believe that we have this feeling the same way with religion or with belief systems, that, yeah, if I can just have this belief system, I feel better. And it's very convenient. All I need is this construct. Maybe someone already made it for me. It doesn't require much. All these people are nice when I go to the church. These are nice people. They support my lifestyle. That makes me feel better. And so you just take it. I'm going to feel better. Boom, I take it. And then you have to, I think humans resist admitting that wasn't right. It was a bad decision. And so they're going to defend their choice of religion. It seems to me that's a very clear idea of why people pick one or another. It could be anything, based on your parents, probably. But it makes you feel better that, I don't have those worries anymore. I can do this now. It takes care of it. I don't have to think about it. It takes care of it. My afterlife, my choices in raising my kids, it's all taken care of by that group of thinking over there that those people did for me. It certainly seems to me a choice of health that, I don't have to think about that anymore. You know, we don't really like effort, apparently. You and I might like to be strong, so we chop wood, we lift weights. But I think a lot of our thinking is to avoid it, to avoid work. That could be an unhealthy situation, but to pick up a belief system that someone else made for you, it's very convenient. And all these people tell you, all the people you hang around with tell you that that's the right belief system. Boy, it's hard to resist that. I think it's very hard to resist that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so convenient, all the ideas to go with. All you have to do is say you're sorry, everything will be forgiven. The trouble is, if you think about a God, all these religions have some God at the head. And usually the God is only favoring the one group of people. How could there be a God that only cares about one group of people with a belief system? It doesn't quite make any sense to me. Why would anyone follow such a God that is going to throw everybody else in damnation and all this stuff?
Yeah, I label myself as, I don't know, atheist or whatever. But Lon is quick to point out that that's an arrogant point of view, and she's absolutely right. That
you're above it, yeah, you're above it.
And it's weird, because when I see people that also claim to be atheists, I see the anger in them, the outspokenness, and then their willingness to prove their point.
Which is exactly the same as the religious fanatic.
Right, and that's why I don't agree with it. So I don't know if that's the right term. It just seems to make sense in that I don't believe in this one thing. So, you know, if I break down the word, that kind of makes more, it's more applicable to me. But I don't know, to me, I'm like, what's all the fuss about?
Yes.
And I see more, I don't know, when I go back after that course, I tended to look more at humanity and enjoying and drawing strength from them and me and the whole, mm-hmm. rather than believing in something else. And I get more pleasure, a sense of, from a healthy standpoint, when I do accomplish these things. I think the unhealthiest thing that I do is get sucked into the trap of procrastination. Like, if I just put it off, I feel better.
Yeah.
Knowing full well that I start to lose sleep.
Yeah.
I start to get stressed.
Yeah.
And it's until I finish it, do I finally actually feel healthy.
I've been trying to bring up this idea in the last few conversations of the voice in your head that tells you you should get up. The voice in your head that tells you you should go to bed. The voice in your head that says you really should help that person. That I totally can believe that's me, but it's a higher me. I really think it's a good voice. it's helping me to do what I know is right. Although I've talked to other people who say they have lots of voices, and most of them are telling me to do things that are wrong. So for me, I really, ever since I've had that voice, I've been cultivating it, listening to it, trying not to shut it up. Because it's, right away I can tell what to do if I listen. And so I take that as the first step on a spiritual path, is that you're not just rationalizing everything. You're not making lists and then saying, well, there's more positive than negative, so I'll do this. You're actually using some sense in you that is saying, no, this is right. And it's a feeling. I think that's the first step toward a spirituality, which is not a religion. It's a human capacity to make decisions based on right and wrong, but it's not based on a creed or a belief system. It's a feeling, an inner feeling of right and wrong. And so I think that's the beginning of a spirituality, separate from religion. And I've been asking people, do you have that voice? Yes, of course. Everyone I've talked to says, yes, they have that voice. It's not a voice, it's not English. But it's a, they call it a voice. And since I'm asking people, I ask you, do you have an idea? Do you have that same thing too? Is that something?
Well, it's, again, it's kind of, I go back to that same man, John.
Good.
And he would talk about the birth of philosophy is whenever someone was sitting down by a fire a long time ago and realized that he could talk to himself in his head.
Yes, yes.
You know, without using any words, just have a conversation.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, throughout, I was able to, like, understand, yes, this, you will just call it a voice because that makes more sense.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
voice that pushes you to do, I don't know, it's treading dangerous ground, but pushing you to do good.
Yes, yes.
But what interested, what I've always more or less been more interested in is why, within that same head, with that same voice, there's the counter.
Yes.
Because what?
Yeah.
I have this push to do this, and yet something is pushing me back, and it all exists inside the same mind.
Yeah.
And why would that be present?
Yeah.
That keeps me from doing what actually makes me feel good.
There's this idea of choice that, and I've been postulating for myself that somewhere along the line I've promoted the one side, not listened to the other, and so now I don't have the choice anymore. In a way, I have less choice, which is a funny paradox, because I think I'm more free than the person who can't help but do the wrong thing. They see, I shouldn't do that, they do it. They do the thing they shouldn't do again and again. I believe they have less choice than I do, but I never... If I hear something saying, this is what you should do, I do it. Because I want to cultivate that side of me. And over time, I've educated my head to not even give me the other side anymore. So in a paradoxical way, I feel more free. I'm not falling into holes like the addict or the criminal. And yet, they seem to have the choice of right and wrong, where I no longer have the choice anymore. I do the right thing. And it's a paradoxical statement to say, I feel very free. I don't know that addicts feel free. Maybe they do. I don't know. But as you say, we have the two. We have more than two. But there's some element of choice in us, which is very weird, that we actually cultivate or deny our own heads to better and worse outcomes. It's very, very
it's
weird.
It's funny when you mention that. It's like you get to a certain level, and then I think, does guilt ever apply anymore? And then,
yeah.
Like people that I think are more free, I guess, are able to think more abstract. And if I do think more abstract, then does my decision have any negative, what I think is a good decision, does it have any negative impact on anyone
yes.
else down
yes,
the line?
Yes, yes.
If so, how can I reason that, and does that become too overwhelming where I,
yes.
I don't know what decision to make at that point.
Yeah. Of course, I'm not in a position to ever make decisions that hurt or help others, except, of course, I'm driving my car. Of course, I'm walking around, but I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a politician, so I do have the ability to hurt people, but very limitedly in my driving. I'm not cutting people off. So some... maybe I can look at that then. I'm driving. I see bad behavior. I can counter bad behavior with bad behavior. And then I can cause harm to others, or I can squash others. All these things can come up that I've, even there, I've pulled myself away from that. I really think there's an education underway in humans that we educate our, let's call it the heart, the sense organ that tells you right from wrong better than the head does, at least as far as I'm concerned, that I've educated mine, or I'm trying to educate mine, so that I never make a decision that hurts people. At least, I don't think I do. Who knows? There you are. If you start to become famous and powerful, people can say, where is this voice coming from again? You know, how do you do that? Who are you listening to? I really think it's our own self becoming educated. You can totally admit that there are people on earth who do the right thing. They're really great. They're marvelous people. And how did they know how to do that? I think it's possible to not hurt people. I think it's actually possible. And to even to deny yourself that you are, maybe that's even the key, is that you are, you, my friend Kofi was saying, you start making decisions that help the world rather than yourself.
Mm.
And that's a very high state. How does that come about? I think it comes out very slowly through this cultivation of the right voice through choice.
Right. How do I get people to think beyond their own satisfaction?
Yeah.
How do I get them to be satisfied, more satisfied with doing it?
I'd rather you ask about yourself, because I have no idea how to help anybody else.
Well, that's the thing. How can I
there you go.
Make a decision
there you go.
That helps other people?
Yeah.
It seems in my job I do Band-Aids. I don't know how much, but every now and then I think I do some healing.
Isn't there education by seeing you? You enter the room. Right away, someone learns something. They see you. Isn't there, haven't you noticed that there is something about certain people? Dogs notice, bees notice. I know dogs and bees. Cats, I suppose, I know a little bit. Children, they see something good. So that's an education right there. And if by your being with them they ask you questions, then you have more opportunity. I'm just saying that your example is the key, I'm sure, that you've worked on yourself, you've become healthy. The way to teach others is simply to exist in front of them. I think that's how you do it.
So just yesterday, the nurses and one of the young lady residents said something to me which I hear a lot, and I'm not going to lie, I feel guilt because of it. I'm a large white male, and for whatever reason people listen to me more and
that's
respond
right.
to me more.
That's right.
And that, you know, and I counter with them. I'm like, that might, you might see some benefit in this interactions, but I promise you it's not the backstage pass that you that I really want.
Because
I hear comments. I am looked upon and thought to be included in a group that I'm not exactly proud of.
Yes, yes.
And all I need to do is go to a town like Lubbock, Texas, and I'm automatically, you know, entered into the club of racist, homophobic, sexist.
There you are.
And it's...
No, it's not. You saw Patrick Stewart... he's this amazing older white guy, and he knows old white guys are listened to. So he's the one, he's using his ability to be listened to by speaking out for the people who aren't listened to. He's actually turning his fame and age and color into a positive force. Yeah, there's this certain gradation of white where you're racist on one side and you're anti-white on the other side. You're so against whites by being white. I mean, there's every group has that. The woman who's anti-feminist and the Jew who's anti-Semitic. You know, there's, I just saw a Bobby Fischer movie, and he's a Jew who's anti-Semitic. But every group has those outliers. But, you know, you can, I think we have a burden we white guys, white males, have great burden.
I believe it.
I mean, it doesn't make us feel, it shouldn't make us feel better because we get all the advantage. I come to the checkpoint and the border guys, they just go, come on, go
that's,
through.
That was my example. Like, I can walk up to like 2 kilos of cocaine. Yeah, sure.
Come on.
Like somebody.
Wasting our time.
You're not going to do anything.
It's
wrong.
So obvious. I was driving around with my African friend up in Pennsylvania, and I'm passing cops on the highway, you know. I own the world in this country. I own the country. It's terrible and wonderful, and I've got to be careful with it.
Oh, and if, I don't know, if you...
We were talking about helping others to... Yeah, they do listen to you. They do see you as, certainly as knowledgeable. Well, I think there's a haze around you that, yeah, you're big and white and a doctor. You got the coat.
But I never ask them to refer. I don't like being told.
Yes.
And people are always like, but you earn that. I'm like,
yeah.
That's not something you earn. It's just, it's what you do. It's what you want to do. I tell them, we're all friends here. We all have a common goal. Your child is sick.
Nice.
We want to get them better.
That can be a strategy to help people better.
But see, as soon as I start thinking about it as a strategy, it loses what I want to get out of it. I want
us to
be friends.
You're totally stuck with that. I don't know what to say.
Before I forget it, you had mentioned the heart, and you were talking about emotions.
As a sense organ, as a way.
You ever heard of, I'm sure you have, someone dying of a broken heart?
Yeah, I've heard that.
If you research, I think it's Takayasu, but octopus heart, it's the Japanese word for octopus heart, you will see that, they noticed it in women, once their spouse had died, their heart becomes very elastic.
Elastic.
And it,
in a bad way?
In a very bad way. And whenever you see, like, they've done studies where they'll inject a dye and they're looking at the heart and the way it pumps, and they'll see it lose its complete structure when it pumps. And it looks like an octopus because it's got the head and it pumps out. And they notice that this poor function can lead to an arrhythmia and a heart attack.
Anecdotally, they related it to the death of a spouse. So.
Right, and they notice it in people who are extremely sad or just under emotional duress.
Interesting.
It is.
And what do you get out of it? Yeah, I mean, out of that. There's a fact, right?
Yeah.
And what do you take from it?
It's very, I don't know, I saw that in med school a long time ago, and I thought that was just so impressive.
That's where science always fails, is what does it mean? We could totally say this is a fact, but then we interpret it.
Yeah.
It's like the superstitious person. It's a windy day, I shouldn't go today. You know, the interpretation is the problem. Yes, it's a windy day.
Are we wrong to always question that, though, Jack? I mean, let's say when you see Millie, the baby, and she smiles at you.
Yeah.
I mean, you could sit back and question, like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Does she understand what it means? Am I interpreting this in the way?
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know, I would find it difficult to find someone who wouldn't see that and then feel happiness and smile.
Yes.
And I don't think we're wrong a lot of times when we make that declaration that that's what that means. I think in a lot of times we overthink our instincts and our primordial
bogs us down, doesn't it? At least it bogs us down. If you're questioning every moment, interpreting, so-called. But then again, what is it then when I see someone smile, a child or otherwise, I feel better without any... I don't think I'm interpreting, but I feel better immediately.
Right.
That's also an interpretation, but it's a directness, too. There's this quickness of intuition, so-called. It's so fast. You like someone, and then you learn about them, and you can question why you like them.
Yeah.
or why you didn't like them. You learn about them. Oh, they're very nice. Everyone says they're nice. But you know you don't like them. I believe intuition is immediate, and a smile can be an intuition, especially in a baby. It's all intuition, right? There's no thinking, so-called, at that age. It's intuition first.
I think that's happiness sometimes, not questioning the simple reflex that my brain tells me.
But humans, for some reason, are trying to get answers to things. It's really weird. I mean, my dog never cared about reasons behind things. They knew what it was to this moment. They know the moment.
As far as we know.
As far as we know. But they're not thinking about the next moment. They're not remembering past moments that much.
I don't know.
We want to put words and thoughts to things. These capacities, the heart capacity, the feeling capacity, it is a reality, and it's quicker than the head capacity. The head takes time. I'm separating the two, but of course it's only one organism. But the heart is immediate, the head takes time. I'm really trying to learn the heart wisdom, so-called, I don't know what words to use, but the quickness of decision-making, right and wrong, an instant. I'm really trying to cultivate that as a more fluid life, a more fluid way of living. And I don't care what anyone calls it, what religion it is. I hope that all religions have the same background of right and wrong and good and bad, and this is how you live better. I'm hoping that was the motivation, at least, of somebody along the line giving these guidelines. Don't kill people, and don't want stuff that isn't yours, that kind of stuff. You hope that they had the background of, this is how you live better. This is how a group of people can live together.
I mean, I don't know, but that goes back to my thoughts about the baby smile. Sometimes I just don't care to know.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes I'm comfortable with the ambiguity or the lack of knowledge about it.
Right.
I mean, I don't... I know
good for you.
I am not so smart that I'm going to figure everything out. And that's, I'm okay with that.
That's great.
And I feel happiness in that.
Yep.
And that's all just all right by me.
You've studied Socrates and Plato, right?
Oh, yeah. So, one thing, one thing I loved about John, I'm glad you brought up Socrates and Plato. He loved those guys.
Yeah.
And he loved them, and he brings it back to the subtext. Because he tells you, like, any good philosopher knows that once you put your thoughts on paper and someone else reads them, they're subject to scrutiny.
That's
and
right.
They will tear it down. They'll find ways around it. So he says, when you're reading philosophy, to look at the things, you know, they're not saying or they're not really focusing on. And I forget which text it was where Plato and another student were going to talk to this other man about, you know, this speech that this man gave. And while they're trying to coax this man to bring out, you know, to tell them again those words, he's all just really more focused or more interested in taking care of his animals. Like, and, you know, John says, maybe there's the meaning. Maybe whatever it was that this man had to say, he realized it's not as important as just living.
Yes.
And
yes.
He found simplicity in the complexity.
Yeah.
I
brought that up because of the smartest guy in the world at the time knew that he knew nothing, right? And what you say? That... You know that you don't know. It's wonderful. But in every life, you see somebody digging a ditch with a smile on their face. And it's hard not to envy that. This guy is living. This guy is living. And I'm not going to waste my time telling him he should be unhappy. He should be unhappy because he didn't go to school. He didn't get the good job. He's digging a ditch. It's not my job to go telling him how he shouldn't be smiling.
I think it's in the... So in both Heart of Darkness, there's a passage where Marlowe is working alongside these people, and he comments on work and how you really connect with another human being or another man when you work alongside them. And I think it's Plato in the first page of
The Republic.
First page where they're describing, like Socrates, they're down, there's a festival, and they're down and they're in the middle of it. They're enjoying it. They're one with their common human. And then they go up an elevation and they look down and they have a totally different viewpoint.
Yeah, there you are. That's when they start meeting philosophers.
Right. And
they spend the whole damn day talking about it. Yeah. No, everyone else is down there drinking.
And they were just in it.
Yeah,
they're
totally
the same human being with the same mind is enjoying and experiencing
it. It's kind of an addiction too that they have. They can't help. Let's see why this is the way it is. Let's understand this. And so they miss the whole thing. What's the value of philosophy though? You can see what love is, and you read about it. It's when you don't expect something from them. Love is a gift in a way. It's not something that you do in exchange for benefits. Oh, okay, now I get it. I wasn't actually in love. I was... what?
I realize that it's not something I need to say. Occasionally it comes out, and when it comes out, it feels more honest and sincere.
Yeah.
And it's really just how I act and how I experience the people I love. Their actions towards me.
Thank you so much, George. You have such a sweet family. Thanks for being my friend. Thanks for talking with me. If you have any comments or questions about what I do here, please drop me a line at reasoningwithanoptimist.net. And I'll hope to give you another conversation next week. This is Jack Bressett Mills. Bye-bye.